You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when refugees resettle in the U.S., there's a big push for them to be self-sufficient. We'll talk to an education anthropologist about why he says we should also be opening up avenues toward higher education. First, the Trump administration is planning to change the way the pork industry is regulated and inspected. A proposal would shift some of the inspection duties at pork plants from USDA officials to employees of the plants themselves. It would also eliminate a cap on line speeds at slaughterhouses, something that's raising concerns about the safety of workers and the food supply. Kimberly Kindy is a national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Kimberly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before, Kimberly, we get into the specific changes that would be made, let's talk about the timeline. This is something that has been in the works and piloted for a while now, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been in five pilot plants for 20 years. So they've been, using a very comparable system. These five plants and what they have learned from using this process serves as the basis for this new proposed inspection system that will transfer a lot of the oversight responsibility to the plant employees away from the USDA inspectors.
Yeah, what are some of the things that are being done by the USDA inspectors now that would be done by a plant employee under this, or I guess has been done by plant employees in the pilot programs and would be more widespread now?
Right. Well, the first thing is that when the live hogs come to a slaughter plant, it is in traditional plants the responsibility of a USDA inspector to determine which hogs are diseased or sick or otherwise unfit for human consumption, and then they are pulled from the slaughter line. A really important part of this is that things like foot and mouth disease have to be detected because if they are turned back to a farm because they just think they're merely sick, that can completely demolish the livestock, and it can have huge economic impacts on not just that farmer, but the entire country. So it's a really important step that in traditional plants, USDA inspectors always did themselves. Under the new system, plant workers will do that job and present at the end of their review of the live hogs the ones that they believe are fit for human consumption and ready for slaughter to USDA inspectors. They will have that second chance to take a look at the animals. The concern for people who are not fans of the proposed system is that some very serious illnesses might not be detected in those pigs that are removed from the slaughter line before, you know, the eyes of USDA inspectors were on every single hog that came in the plant.
So that's when the hogs are on their way in.
Yep.
How about detection of problems, while they're being slaughtered or after they're being after they've been slaughtered?
Sure. So one of the most important points on the line that were duties USDA inspectors always did were they would look for contamination, fecal contamination, which obviously is a serious food safety issue. This will be a shared responsibility with plant workers. There'll be more plant workers on the line doing that job versus USDA inspectors in large plants, for instance, be seven of them instead of, and now seven USDA inspectors used to have the job of looking for defects, contamination, disease, and now there'll only be three of them in a large plant in the system. So it's, fecal contamination is obviously very important. E. coli makes people very sick, kills people. Another part on the line that's really important is USDA inspectors used to pull out all of the internal organs and look at them and look for signs of disease that could be very important in telling about the condition of the hog. Now a plant employee pulls all them out and pulpates them and does, overview on that while a USDA inspector is overseeing that task. So a different role and the hands-on thing is really done by the plant and workers themselves now.
If this change becomes more widespread, does this mean every slaughterhouse, every place that handles pigs will make this change, just some of them? How would this play out?
No. It would be, it's in five plants right now in the testing program, and then another 35 are expected to join. Now, there's 612 plants in America, so that sounds like maybe just a fraction of the plants, but in truth, these 40 plants produce 90% of the pork that's consumed in the United States. So it would be the primary way in which hogs would be inspected in America.
Talking to Kimberly Kendi from the Washington Post about a proposed change in how the USDA and plant workers would handle inspections of pigs as they come into and out of slaughterhouses. And Kimberly, you talked to some former USDA officials and others who were worried about what this means, both for food safety and, as you're saying, for the safety of the herds of pigs, if we call them herds. What kind of concerns did you hear?
Well, they have huge food safety concerns. There was a 2013 report that came out, the Government Accountability Office, where they, you know, looked at the how well those five plants did compared to five comparably sized plants, and with food safety issues. And they performed; they were the three of the five were the some of the among the most worst performing plants in the United States. That independent government report found there hasn't been since. The Inspector General and the Government Accountability Office have analyzed that there haven't been any independent reviews of how safe they are. The USDA put out its own report back in 2014, so it's been a while, saying that it was as safe and as good as the current system, but not that it is better. Their hope is that it would improve food safety, but no data has been really released that would prove that.
So if that's the case, that the best case is a break-even point when it comes to safety, what has been the argument for making these changes?
Well, the argument remains that that USDA and hog industry believe that it would make food safer. The confusing part of that argument is that they say that USDA inspectors cannot spot the things that are the most important and the most serious danger when it comes to food safety and foodborne illnesses. It's those microscopic pathogens that cannot be spotted. But in order to determine if those pathogens are present, you have to do testing. And right now, there are no plans for salmonella testing in those plants or in other plants, in hog plants. And they also were doing away with the generic E. coli test. So although that's their argument, there aren't, USDA tests that would be, you know, sort of taking the place and publicly released data that would show how well they're doing with ridding themselves of the microscopic pathogens.
Another piece of the puzzle is the speed of the slaughter lines. The changes would allow pork companies to speed up the rate of those lines. What are people looking at when it comes to food safety and worker safety?
Right. So with food safety, the concern is that you have fewer inspectors on the line. On average, it would be 40% reduction, so fewer eyes rot on the line. And then on top of it, the line speed is going really, really fast. There's a huge dependence now on the USDA inspector who's at the very end of the line. So imagine fewer eyes on it coming before you, and you're the person between the product and the public. And now everything's moving faster. So the concern is that fewer eyes, and then the fewer eyes also have to spot things much, much more quickly. And that translates in the minds of a lot of food safety experts and the former USDA veterinarian, the chief veterinarian, that translates into potential food safety dangers.
Is all of this a done deal, or is there still process to determine whether meat plants can do this?
Well, the rule hasn't been finalized, but the conversations that USDA officials have had with stakeholders, including their own union, the USDA inspectors, is that they are expecting to take this rule and send it over to the White House for a final evaluation, and that they're hoping that, you know, that will pass. It's all that we're hearing is that it's looking good for that to happen. And so we're talking weeks if it ends up rolling along the way they're predicting and hoping.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kimberly Kindy, national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. She was with us to talk about a federal proposal to give the pork industry more control over food safety inspections. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the barriers to higher education facing Wisconsin's refugee community. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin saw the fourth largest cut in higher education funding between 2013 and 2018, according to a national report. We'll learn more about the issue in just a bit. First, when refugees resettle in the U.S., the federal government's top priority is to help them become self-sufficient and to do that quickly. That means things like connecting them with employers and finding housing they can afford. But our next guest says that the focus on rapid economic self-sufficiency can come at the cost of refugees' goals to go to college or to build on professional certifications from their home countries. That could have a big effect on their economic potential in the long run. Matt Wolfgram is Assistant Director of the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison. He's the author of a recent piece for WisContext called Why the Educational Dreams of Refugees Get Put on the Back Burner. You can read that over at wiscontext.org. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
So what kind of pressure do refugees face when they resettle to be, I guess, self-sufficient to get any kind of job as soon as possible?
Well, so, you know, we've spent at this for our research, we spent some time talking to educators, resettlement service providers, and refugees themselves. And we've found this, that this sort of the pressure to immediately obtain sort of economic self-sufficiency, this is something that's in the federal resettlement guidelines, that tends to be an obstacle or a barrier to refugees accessing higher education or even pursuing that if they have that goal.
And when you talk to refugees, do a lot of them have that desire or hope that they'll go into some form of college?
Well, there's a couple of different situations. I mean, so in the modern world, we do have conflicts that sometimes take that can be very protracted, lasting decades in some cases, unfortunately. And so when someone becomes a refugee, they might spend, you know, a good portion of their youth and young adulthood in a camp or as an urban refugee, so being displaced from their homeland. They may have access to college at that time. So they may, when they come to the United States or to Wisconsin, they may have college credits that they want to continue, or they want to see how those can translate here. And so that's one situation. And the other situation are people who come here either as youth or as adults, and they want to pursue college as a goal. And we don't really know the numbers right now. We don't really have a way to say that. But in our experience, in our research, we do find we have no problem finding refugees who have that goal and are pursuing, working towards it.
Let's look at each of those situations in turn. First, that refugee who might have some higher education, some credits. How hard is that to track down for someone who's coming, as you say, maybe from a refugee camp or a country where their educational facility might literally have been destroyed? How hard is that for them to establish those credentials?
That's a great question, and it's something that I've been learning a lot about, and it's surprising how difficult it can be. The system that's set up for vetting educational credentials here in the United States and in Wisconsin is really set up to make sure that international students have the appropriate background and can succeed as students in American universities. It's not set up to help refugees have their credentials recognized and to succeed. As you said, their college, the records may be gone. They may not have the records. The college may be gone itself. The way that our system is set up, there's these various kind of bureaucratic requirements, having to send a signed, sealed transcript directly from the university. If a university on our end in the United States is only willing to accept, you know, the top level of credentialing, many refugees will just it will be impossible for them to actually produce those. And then that can become a major obstacle.
And then for that other group of refugees talked about, maybe they're adults who want to go back and get some kind of higher education, or they are high school students looking to go into college soon after high school. What kind of obstacles does a refugee face in that situation?
So it's a little different for each of those groups. For young people who come, they enter, you know, usually the public education, K-12 public education system. In Wisconsin, in Madison and in other districts in Wisconsin, refugees are able to, because of their sort of special status, they're able to stay on after 18 for a couple of years to get some of the basic education that they can use. And that's a great policy. That really helps those young people. For adults, it's that, a major barrier, it's that pressure to obtain immediate self-sufficiency. I mean, the goal here is to have them obtain some basic employment so that they can be off of resettlement and social services as quickly as possible. While that is a good goal, it can get in the way of a larger sort of, you know, flourishing and more prosperous self-sufficiency, which can come with higher education for those refugees.
We're talking with Matt Wolfgram from the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison, talking about the challenges refugees here in the U.S., here in Wisconsin, face when they're trying to get some form of higher education. Matt, big picture, is the idea of refugees getting higher education kind of an afterthought in our system, given that we've got a lot of other challenges, language, culture, jobs, as you say, housing? Higher education may come up pretty low on that list.
I get that thought, refugees do face a number of, I think you would say, sort of very basic social economic struggles when they come to the United States. They don't go to college right away and in 4 years graduate and join the professional workforce. It's not that sort of linear kind of middle class, white middle class experience. With the persistence that they show as individuals and with supports through the refugee resettlement program and through educators, the educators in our state, they are able to succeed. They do succeed and eventually enter the professional workforce. And that higher education for refugees is valuable not only for finding, you know, professional employment, but many refugees, just like, you know, sort of other residents, Wisconsinites, they sometimes need to change their careers, sometimes more than once throughout their lives. And that higher education is good for that. It provides that sort of more general learning and flexibility in the workforce.
And in the piece you co-wrote for WisConText, you profiled at least one refugee who had gone through higher education and I guess kind of a success story. Can you talk about that?
So lately, in our research, we've been doing some really, really interesting and exciting work where we've been interviewing refugees. I've been focusing on Somali refugees in Wisconsin, and we've been learning their stories. They're really remarkable what they go through to get to this country and to become, you know, Wisconsinites and settle into our communities, and then their persistence at becoming educated and succeeding in transitioning to the workforce. And so I was talking with a Somali refugee actually just today, just before I came in today. And she went to Madison College, received great support there to kind of clarify her career goal. She decided to become a nurse, and she is a nurse now. She works here in our community in Madison as a nurse, and which is a great benefit to our community and also to Somalis who can then have a qualified nurse who's also Somali working with them.
Yeah, do you focus, I've thought about this mostly in terms of the benefit to the refugee of being able to get into a higher education, a college or university. What social benefits do you see for, say, Wisconsin at large?
So I think one is that I think educated refugees can provide leadership to the refugee community and can kind of mediate between the refugee community itself and the institutions in our society that are there for Wisconsinites' well-being. So education, health, government, these educated refugees can sort of provide, be a broker or a mediator between mainstream institutions and the refugee community. But, I'll just say that the benefit that they bring is in part their stories. You know, these people have really lived incredible lives. They come to Wisconsin, they find, you know, success, or that, you know, they struggle and find success. And it's really, they're really incredible stories. And I'm fortunate to know some of them, and we're going to try and get them out through different media.
Do you see ways, maybe tweaks in the system that might open the door a little wider for refugees to get access to higher education?
Well, the one that I've been focusing on, the one that I've been really troubled by quite a bit is the barriers to refugees who have credentials already, college, higher education credentials, or professional credentials. There's no reason that they should be, you know, the pressure should be that they should not, you know, sort of finish those credentials or have them translated into sort of the American system, and they can contribute to their community and to Wisconsin more broadly. So I feel like some changes in how enrollment offices vet the credentials of refugees. I think that's a very common sense and proposal that I think would have quite a bit of impact.
We'll leave it there for now. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
That was Matt Wolfgram, an anthropologist of education and senior researcher at the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about the barriers to higher education facing Wisconsin's refugee population. You can find his essay on this topic over at wiscontext.org. Coming up, a related issue, we'll learn about the state of higher education funding here in Wisconsin. A new national report looks at changes in state funding for colleges and universities since the Great Recession. Wisconsin comes in fourth from lowest. We're seeing a decline, and we're toward the bottom of that list. We'll dig into why that is and what it means for students here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:45 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests share the latest news about the spread of antibiotic-resistant diseases here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 6:45 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to a new national report, Wisconsin saw the fourth most significant decline in per-student higher education spending in the country. That's according to the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association, which looked at data from all 50 states from 2013 to 2018. While many states saw a decline in this kind of spending following the Great Recession, many of them recovered and reversed the trend. Wisconsin has been slower to recover. Our next guest is here to talk about that report and the overall health of Wisconsin's higher education financing system. Nicholas Hillman is an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
All right, looking at this report, big picture, it's a big deal, looking at what has happened in college funding since the Great Recession. What do you think of where Wisconsin stacks up here?
Well, just post-recession, Wisconsin is certainly towards the bottom of the nation in terms of recovery. A lot of other Midwestern states are still struggling to get back to pre-recession levels or even close to pre-recession levels, but Wisconsin especially so. And this data goes back to 1980. They started reporting this, gosh, in the 80s. And Wisconsin's trend even since then has just been going south. And so we, on a per-student basis, invest less today than we did, not just since the Great Recession, but since the 1980s.
And what is driving that change?
You know, several factors. I think politically, I think that there are just competing pressures that policymakers are prioritizing over higher education. I think that there might be a public mood that higher education pays off, and so individuals should share more of that financial burden. And I think that this is sort of a trend of uncoordinated policy in a lot of ways. We across the nation, but I think in Wisconsin especially, we don't necessarily have a plan on how to kind of keep the funding steady over time. And so I think all those things and several others probably play into this.
You mentioned the cost burden going to the person who gets the benefit of the education. Does that mean tuition has gone up as a result of this change in funding?
Yes and no. So tuition has stayed pretty flat, and the University of Wisconsin system has, by policy, had to have a flat tuition. But tuition only counts for maybe about 40% of the total cost of attendance, and so it's all of these non-tuition expenses that leave people on the hook to pay for housing, room, and board, and a number of other factors that it takes to invest in yourself. Tuition is important, but not the whole. Not the whole pie.
And that flat tuition, that applies to in-state undergraduates for the most part, right? Have other students out of state graduate school seen costs go up in Wisconsin?
That's right. So that in-state cap is for residents. And so, yes, tuition can rise for other groups of students.
Now, this is becoming a political issue. We've seen a major Democratic presidential candidate talk about trying to aim for tuition-free school, forgiving student loan debt. Have we seen this as a big political issue in years past?
In years past, yes. I'd say the Obama administration put higher education on the national radar in a number of ways, primarily by focusing on community colleges. One of the big initial efforts was the American Graduation Initiative that kind of never really took full flight from the Obama administration, but really put higher education on the radar nationally. And then in our most recent presidential election, both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton had higher education as a part of their agendas. And just today I was reading a writer for The Atlantic, Adam Harris, says that basically a free tuition policy is your ticket to the Democratic convention if you're running for office.
Now, getting back to this report, why is Wisconsin low on this chart when it comes to per student funding from 2013 to 2018? What were we doing differently than many other states?
We had significant budgetary cuts to the UW system during that period of time when most other states were trying to either reinvest or at least kind of come back to pre-recession levels. And in the state of Wisconsin, we had significant cuts. And my understanding is that those were not because our economy was doing poorly as it was in the recession, because we've seen significant cuts during recessionary times. But this one was it was an off-recession budgetary cut that I would say boils down to politics and priorities, and I think a general public sentiment of distrust towards public higher education, which is sort of amplified in the conservative base.
Now, if funding is being cut to schools, especially those schools that don't have that big out-of-state student population where they can raise tuition from, something's got to give. I guess, what are we seeing for a lot of UW schools around the state when it comes to their funding?
Well, so funding in public higher education is such a mixed bag. You have some institutions that have multiple revenue sources. They might have a foundation that can generate money. They might have spinoffs or sort of entrepreneurial activities that can generate money. And on the other end of the spectrum, you might have institutions that are pretty much dependent on state appropriations and tuition as their main sort of bread and butter of revenue. And so the institutions that have the most diverse revenue streams are the ones that can handle these kind of ebbs and flows and these trends better than those that are more reliant on state appropriations.
Talking to Nicholas Hillman, Associate Professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at a new national report on per-student college spending, finds Wisconsin in the lower part of the charts across the nation since the year 2013. Nick, are we just talking about public schools in this, or are private schools that are a big part of the story, obviously, are they factored into these numbers?
They're factored in there in some metrics, but for the most part, this is all about public institutions. So this includes the University of Wisconsin system, but also it includes the two-year colleges and the Wisconsin Technical College system, which is really important because there could be different trends even within those sectors that aren't being captured here.
Now, when it comes to college affordability, we hear the perception anyway that college today costs a lot more than it did 30 years ago, say. Is that perception matching with reality?
when it comes to the out-of-pocket expense that an individual student has to pay, yes, absolutely, that's the case. There's been an intergenerational shift here where this generation, more recent generation, is not just paying more out-of-pocket, but the whole relationship with state appropriations and tuition has just flipped. So, for example, in the 1980s, it was about $3 came in from the state for every $1 that the student paid. So 3-to-1 ratio thereabouts. But now it's 1-to-1, and in fact, Wisconsin in 2016 flipped, where we're getting more money from individual students than we are from the state tax base.
And that's the state funding. How about federal funding and student aid?
Well, the big federal pie comes through the federal Pell Grant, and that's a scholarship and grant program that students don't have to repay. And that has not kept pace with the rising tuition that has been charged over the past several decades. The main other pie is student loan debt, and that has just been steadily growing. And so for a student, yes, it's more expensive today to go to college than ever before. But at the same time, this is what makes this problem even more complicated, is that the payoff is still there for somebody who earns a degree on average. And so some people would say, and I'd argue this too, it's more expensive to not go to college. So even though it's expensive and even though there are significant debts to carry that can affect you for your life, not going to college could also be very expensive.
Now, you recently, I know, testified before Congress on some of these issues on not just affordability, but how colleges respond to concerns about affordability. What kind of things were you looking at there?
Well, it runs the whole gamut, but I think a large part of that conversation, at least at the federal level, is how colleges can be more accountable for the outcomes of their student loans that are awarded at colleges. So, for example, an institution might have really high student loan debt on average of its graduates. And from the federal perspective, colleges might not have enough of incentive to prevent students from carrying large debts in the first place, and maybe even might not help them pay those debts down in the future, might not prepare them well for the labor market to pay those debts down. And so at the federal level, federal policymakers are very interested in holding colleges more accountable for loan outcomes.
There's kind of a fundamental argument I think we hear when we hear about the high costs of college and high student loan debts. One argument is, well, don't go to a college you can't afford. And a common response is, so if we go by that principle, we're basically taking today's wealth hierarchy and saying that's what it's going to be tomorrow. The rich people go to the rich schools and so on down the line. How does that all shake out as you look at these issues?
That is really how it shakes out. We have an extremely stratified system of higher education where the colleges that have the fewest resources tend to also serve the students who have the greatest needs and come from maybe the first in their family to go to college. And so we really are upside down in that respect. At the same time, the institutions that have the most resources tend to be a more affordable option for lower income students who can get in. And so that's the trick, is making sure that the public institutions that can hold down those tuition rates and hold down those loan debts are also expanding opportunities for the people from the lowest income families.
We're talking to Nick Hillman right now about the state of higher education spending in Wisconsin. He's an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the news in this report? Wisconsin has seen higher education funding go down in the last five-year period on a per-student basis. That doesn't compare favorably to most states. What would you like to see change, if anything, when it comes to higher education funding? And what questions do you have about how college funding works, how tuition is set, and how student debt gets accumulated by students around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the state of higher education funding in Wisconsin. A recent national report found that the state saw the fourth largest decline in per-student spending during a five-year period starting in 2013. Nick Hillman is with us, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis for UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin has made higher education, the colleges, the two-year colleges, the technical colleges, a high enough priority when it comes to budgets? What would you like to see as we enter a new budget year? What would you like to see when it comes to how we fund colleges and universities? And what do you think of the trend, as Nick was saying earlier, of more of the cost of college coming from the student, less coming from the state and federal government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. As always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's get back to Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren running for president, talking about her plan for to cut college tuition to zero, I guess, in many cases, and student loans. And just during the break, you're talking about you'd heard her use the phrase a failed experiment about our student loan system. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a statement. It's a term that stood out to me because I hadn't heard other elected officials or people running for office frame it in this way. And so this argument is that this is, like she said, a failed experiment, but an intergenerationally sort of unequal experiment too, where the baby boomer generation had a totally different way of paying for college and doesn't totally have the same opportunities for this generation of students now. And so that's part of the framing of the argument. Her proposal, as I understand it, would include not just a debt forgiveness for sort of a sliding scale sort of for different income groups. You'd have different levels of debt forgiven if this goes through, but also some degree of investment and commitment from states to match what I believe is at least going to be a matching grant between the federal and state governments to try to have a shared system of support that we currently don't really have coordinated across federal and state governments right now.
Looking at the history of how schools have been funded here in Wisconsin, we're seeing this decline again in this last 5-year period. Before that, how did Wisconsin stack up when it came to commitments to funding higher education?
In terms of appropriations per student, Wisconsin was right at the top of the pack in terms of support per student being high in the Midwest, probably throughout the 1990s. But it has bounced around over time, depending on a number of factors that we discussed earlier. But Wisconsin has both been at the top and now towards the bottom in terms of the Midwest and appropriations per student.
And how much of that can we blame on the Great Recession itself, or how much of that was policy decisions that were made regardless of that?
It's hard to say. I think across the country, though, the Great Recession has really changed the way that states finance higher education. I think that that was a big hit to income for middle-income families especially. People don't have the resources and the assets to pay for college, and so there was some degree of interest in responding to that and making college more affordable because of it. But at the same time, you don't have as much tax base to draw from. So it's really complicated. And so I'd say it's a little bit of both.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Ben with us in Eau Claire. Ben, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ben?
Great. So I teach in the Community and Technical College system, and I am soon going to be looking to make the jump from the 2-year system to the 4-year system. And I was just wondering if the guest could comment on the future of the state schools, the private schools, and the community college system in the state of Wisconsin, maybe from a faculty perspective, and then specifically about the sustainability and things like that.
Great question. I'll jump in.
Sure.
So I think on one hand, you have a different cost structure across the different sectors of higher education. So delivering a course in a community college, depending on the course, of course, is going to have different cost structure than delivering a course at a private or a public research university, for example. This does not always apply, but there are different cost structures here. There are also different faculty models of how faculty have positions within the institutions, how much they get compensated for those positions, and those are also changing. So I would say, on average, the tech college, community college system is going to be a less expensive education to deliver. So from many vantage points, that might be a more desirable one to fund via state subsidies.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ben. One concern people raise when they hear about the cost of higher education is the expense, the costs for the schools themselves, and whether we have a lot of, I guess, frills at colleges. Are we paying for stuff that we don't need?
That's a really hard one to answer. I think that question will continue to be asked because it's so hard to answer. Mm-hmm. But here are two ways to think about it. The first is that any educational institution is driven not by climbing walls and lazy rivers, as is sometimes painted. The picture is kind of painted of institutions. But the big cost driver is people, is the salaries, wages, benefits, healthcare, all that goes into having highly trained professionals work in the space of teaching and learning and discovery. And so from that angle, it's just an expensive enterprise. And even if you had a no-frills enterprise, it would still be very expensive on that level. On the other level, there is pressure to be sort of recognized for having high quality. But the problem is that quality is very hard to measure in education, higher education in particular. And so we don't necessarily have a good metric of quality. And so sometimes we just say, well, if you spend a lot, if you deliver a really expensive education, it must be better. And so there's partly, you know, it's part of both of those things.
We're talking to Nicholas Hillman, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at a new report in education, higher education spending in the 50 states, finds Wisconsin has gone down when it comes to per student funding. We're fourth lowest in the nation on that rating of states. Do you see a movement, Nick, to change that here in Wisconsin? We have a new budget plan from Governor Evers. We're likely to see a different plan from Republicans in the state legislature. Do you see an appetite to change this?
I do. I do. I think that the public perception of higher education is still skeptical, I think, in many respects of the institutions themselves. But I think that the value proposition of what you get for having not just your own family well-educated, but your neighbors to have a nice round educational opportunity, the payoff there and the value added is there. And so I think people are very interested in that process. I think that communities and policymakers are really facing significant challenges right now. And because of that, they might say, well, higher education is sort of on the back burner. We have other priorities like opioid epidemic or environmental emergencies or you name it. We have all these other problems that are facing us today. And so because of that, they might put higher education on the back burner. And I would say that this budget kind of recalibrates that and says, well, if you want to solve those problems, you need a well-educated workforce, a well-educated citizenry to be able to be problem solvers. And so I think those worlds are hopefully converging.
Let's bring on another caller now. Charles is with us in Trevor. Charles, hello.
Hi there. Just calling to share kind of my experience mm-hmm. with all this. A couple years back, I was accepted into a technical college program for CNC production. I completed that. It was state-funded through Wisconsin. After completing it, I worked for about 2 years, and I just went back and completed a CNC programming technical diploma on my own accord. I still owe the money for that. And my main comment was that I would be pursuing, you know, probably an engineering degree at the moment. It just seems to be a little out of my range, and I would love for there to be, you know, more help with that sort of thing. And I really appreciate you guys talking about this.
Charles, thanks a lot for the call. So somebody with what sounds like a demonstrated commitment to finishing whatever course of education he's in, do we have those pathways for somebody like Charles to get that, say, four-year engineering degree?
There may be pathways I'm unfamiliar with, but I think that the point earlier that I think he articulated for me so well is that it's more expensive to miss out on those opportunities. That cost to society is greater if he's not enrolled in those programs, and the benefits that he can bring to his family and communities by enrolling, those costs are far greater than him not going at all. So I think that's the spirit there, is that investing in him can help sort of invest in those broader benefits.
Thanks for the call, Charles. Good luck. In our last minute or so, Nick, do you see anybody who's gotten this right? A state, a college, who's done a great job, you think, of getting college costs down and making the access for students like Charles?
No. Not there. Not there yet.
Wow.
I think some states are finding solutions that are at least addressing some of these problems. I know in Tennessee, for example, they have a Reconnect program where adults like who are returning to education can get a tuition fully covered, and they're investing in that. And I think that's a promising idea. There are other states that are requiring, the FAFSA form, the free application for federal student aid. They're requiring that as part of high school graduation. And so they're like sort of pieces and parts of things that seem promising, but I haven't seen one state just really put it all together and have a comprehensive approach that also addresses those resource inequalities we mentioned earlier.
We'll leave it there for now. Nick, thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Nicholas Hillman, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He joined us today to talk about a recent report that found Wisconsin saw the fourth largest decline in per-student higher education spending in the country in a five-year period, 2013 to 2018. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll take a look at the nation of Sri Lanka after this weekend's series of tragic terror attacks. Also, is a social media friend a real friend? We'll take a look at changing relationships in the age of social media. Plus, insects, they're what's for dinner. A chef speaking this week in Wisconsin introduces us to the world of cooking and eating insects. And yes, we'll get some advice on how to prepare them. All that, plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day and your thoughts on all these issues. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, a prominent Wisconsin conservative makes the case that the problems facing the state require more local solutions and less involvement.